Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got to know.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Welcome to Table 2 at Harrah's St. Louis, the home every Tuesday afternoon of The Final Table. Today on the show, another member of the World Series of Poker, November 9 for 2010. Matt Jarvis will join us in a little while. Also, we're going to get into an in-depth discussion of how the poker world has turned against one of the world's largest brick-and-mortar poker rooms. I'm Paul Harrah, sitting alongside Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips, who is back from yet another road trip. 1 week ago today, Dennis, we were talking to you live from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, where you were playing in the Canadian Poker Open.
Well, that, and I've actually squeezed another trip in between because I went over to the Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, also over the weekend.
Just outside of Cincinnati.
Just about 35 minutes from Cincinnati.
Wow. There. All of that in just the last week.
Yeah. Like I said, American Airlines loves me.
Now, Matt Jarvis, our guest today, actually was up there with you in Canada, as were other pros like Gavin Smith and Brad Booth, and you mentioned that Lacey Jones was there
as
well.
Sure.
You were going to play a week ago today in the 5K Heads Up Championship there, which had 64 entrants.
Correct.
You got a bye in round one,
yeah.
Made it into round two, which would be the round of 32. How did it go?
Won that round, took two straight from a gentleman up there to the round of 16, went against one of the better Omaha players that I've seen. I was watching him in the cash game in there, a very good, solid Omaha player. We sat down and played first hand that we actually played. He took about 80% of my chips.
Oh,
yeah.
Cooler hand or just a set over set or something like
nah,
that?
No, I had pocket tens, believe it or not, and on an 8-high board flop, we ended up getting it all in. As it turned out, he called my preflop raise with a 7-4 and flopped a straight.
Oh, nice.
And he was the one that shoved, and I just couldn't lay down an overpair at that heads up. It's very, I don't know, I just couldn't do it.
Yep.
I put him on a massive draw. I thought, well, we might even be even a 50-50, but I put him on a draw, a straight draw, flush draw type thing. And mm-hmm. It wasn't. He had it already.
Okay.
So, anyhow, I came back.
What was the flop? 8-6-5?
Exactly.
So his 7-4 hit?
Yes, exactly.
So at that point, maybe you're even putting him on a pair of sevens. So he's got the pair and the open ender. And
heads up is so much different than regular cash.
Right.
If you've never played a lot of heads up, you don't know it. Laying down an overpair to almost any flop is very difficult to do. I've done it before heads up, but it's difficult to do.
Yep.
And in this case, I barely knew it. I've only played a couple of hands with a guy. Yeah, it just, my chips are going in there, and we'll see what happens.
Yep.
So I was down. We started with 10K each. I was down to a little over right at 2,000, about 2,100, I think. And then I ended up winning that one.
Wow.
I came back from it. We played a marathon. This whole thing from getting in, this is heads up, and we're playing 2 out of 3. It took 5.5 hours to finish.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Yeah, we were the last ones playing out of that round.
Wow.
But it took probably close to 2 hours to finish that one. I came all the way back to 12, went back down to 4, and then ended up doubling up and then doubling up again, had him dominated. And once I got him dominated, I pretty much just chewed him down.
Uh-huh.
So, but anyhow, into the first one, won that one. Came into the second one. We're playing again. I love this hand. Got pocket tens again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit.
I would have mucked them right there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Don't care what happens. I'm not playing. I saw what happened before. Why would I play them again? I'm kidding, of course.
It was unbelievable. But I pocket tens again. I raised preflop again. He smooth called me. A flop came out there of an 8-6-3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well,
you know he doesn't have 7-4.
This is true. There is no possible straight out there.
Yeah.
Well, to make a long story short, it comes again on the flop, and he ends up shoving. A couple of raises back and forth. I've got my pocket ten. He shoves, and I went into the tank. I mean, it's almost a deja vu, but he could have had an 8-6. He could have had a massive draw again. He could have had a set. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities.
Yeah, he could have had 3s, 6s, or 8s.
Oh, exactly. You know, whatever. Who knows on this thing? I went into it. I studied the guy the whole bit. There was a reason why I called him, because the reaction he had here was different than the identical hand that we'd had like an hour and a half beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with my gut feeling and said, don't believe it. This time you don't have it. I call. Guy looks at me and he's big sigh, and he turned over a 6-4 offsuit.
Mm-hmm. On an 8-6-3 board.
Yeah. So he had middle pair.
Uh-huh.
So turn card comes. I can't remember what it was. Didn't make any difference. It was a total blank. We're both standing up. It's over, right? Six on the river.
He has a five-outer, and he hits one of them to make trips.
So anyhow, it happened. And this is a good player, though. Don't get me wrong. I'm not dishing him at all. Making that move, if I'd had anything less than pocket tens, I probably would have had to lay it down. Mm-hmm. Situationally, it wasn't a bad play. It was a risky play, but it wasn't a bad play.
Mm-hmm.
We played the third. The third one, we were almost 2 hours into it and ended up losing that one. So the six cost me a minimum of $13,000, which is what eighth place paid.
Because if you make it to the round of
eight,
you get a minimum cash of 13.
13 and change, something like that.
Oh,
so,
man.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's poker. I'm not bellyaching at all. It was there. It was a good quality guy, a good guy that I played against. The third match was very heated and back and forth. I went kind of card dead, and he took advantage of it, which he should.
Yep.
That's the way you play heads up.
Absolutely.
I got a little card dead. He just started being very aggressive and pushing, and I got down to about 4,800, I think, and I had an ace four. Unfortunately, when he looked at his hand, he had an ace queen.
Mm-hmm.
So
no four on the flop, obviously.
No four on the flop on this one, no.
Yeah. So that'll do it. How'd the other pros do? Brad Booth, Matt Jarvis, Gavin Smith, Lacey Jones.
It was really interesting. Gavin played Lacey on the first round just by luck of the draw because it's purely random draw, and Lacey won. Lacey went into the second round and played against the gentleman that, from Germany, and it took forever. They had a marathon match, and she ended up losing on that one.
Okay.
Brad was the first one through on the first round, and I think the first one through on the second round. Unfortunately, he ran into Matt Jarvis on the third round.
Uh-huh.
Matt is on a bit of a roller coaster or streak right now. He is just going hot as can be. And he took out Brad, and then he went on to win it.
Oh, wow.
He won the 5K up there
well,
in Canada.
Well, we'll have to talk about that
Absolutely
with him when he joins us here in a few minutes.
Because I was not there when he played the final, and so I'm not for sure what happened or even who he played against. Now, I'm really curious myself. There's some good quality players up there. It was fun to play, and I love a 5K, especially that structure.
Yeah.
So it was a very good structure, a good way to play poker, not just a shove fest like some of them can be.
All right, so then on to the Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. And what was going on there?
They had the Indiana State Poker Championships hosted by the Hollywood Casino. It was the first really major casino in all of Indiana. They host this annually. The casino itself is phenomenal. They've sunk about $350 million into it in the last year, totally redone it, enlarged it by about four or five-fold what it used to be. It was a riverboat similar to what we have here in Missouri. They still have the riverboat, but they've turned that into a nightclub. So you can go downstairs to the nightclub. You can go over to the poker room. That's a 41-table poker room and a 60-table tournament room on top of that. So they have over 100 tables there that you can play at.
Mm-hmm.
And they had up to 900 people in some of the preliminary events. We played the main event. They invited me over. I got really took care of me well on the deal. Unfortunately, they also put a bounty on my head during this tournament.
Now, that changes how people play against you, right?
Well, I'm not for sure the guy with the 7-4 would have called me. Again,
7-4 again?
7-4 again.
Oh.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this time the flop was a 6-5-3.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, two kings doesn't beat a straight.
Really?
Really, yeah. So that pretty well crippled me, and then from then on it was just whatever. But it was a fun time. Enjoyed it. I will definitely be going back there. A lot of players are over there playing that you would know. I mean, Billy Kopp that played there, Joe Bishop that was there. A lot of the Reds that come out there and play. I actually played with a coach from the Atlanta Hawks while I was there. They're having a roast on for Pete Rose in a couple of weeks, and they've got almost all of the Big Red Machine coming there for dinner.
Wow.
Beautiful casino. I'm not for sure. What is it? 4,000 slots they have there, 100 other table games.
I think they host a WPT event there.
They have
a
WPT, televised WPT. They're going to have, they had the first one last year, and they're going to have this one coming up in March.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I will probably go back to that.
Did you just play one or two events?
I played two events. The second event, I got 12th in. It was just a nice, fun one, a couple hundred people in it. Made a little cash, made a lot of friends.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very, very enjoyable weekend.
Nice.
Lawrenceburg, Kansas. The
Lawrenceburg,
casino.
Indiana.
Lawrenceburg, Indiana.
Just outside of Cincinnati.
Yeah, a little ways from Kansas. Never mind.
But not all that far from St. Louis.
No, not at all.
The day's drive.
It's about a five-hour drive.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about some poker news here. And I think one of the big stories of the last couple of days, Dennis, has been the battle between the Poker Players Alliance and the Commerce Casino. Now, those of you who don't know the Commerce Casino, which is just outside of Los Angeles, it is, well, they bill themselves as the world's largest poker room. They have more than 200 tables there. I've gone to play in some cash games there a couple of times, always had a great time. They have, you know, inexpensive hotel rooms and free food. So it's a lot of people call it poker players' paradise.
Well, it is, and I've played out there myself, and I have to admit they really treat the poker players well. There's tons of action of almost any level you want and tons of different type of games. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there's something going on in the Commerce, and they know how to take care of the people.
Yeah, they do. Well, they haven't been taking care of the poker players, at least those of us who are members of the Poker Players Alliance, which last week called for members of the PPA, and if you're not one, you can join up at theppa.org. They decided to get on the case of the Commerce Casino because Commerce had one of their people testify a couple of weeks ago when Barney Frank had his House Financial Committee meeting when they were going to be marking up the online poker regulation bill, H.R. 2267. And one of their guys, Tom Malkasian, testified in opposition of the bill. And the Poker Players Alliance decided to say to Commerce, we can't believe that you're not supporting poker players here. Because if we can get online poker licensed and regulated in the United States, that's going to be good for everybody in poker. 7,000 people have signed the online petition, which is really an open letter to the Commerce Casino. And if you haven't seen it yet, you can either go to theppa.org or playersbeforeprofits.com. Dennis and I have both signed it. So have poker pros like Howard Lederer and Jennifer Harmon and Gus Hansen and Greg Raymer, Barry Greenstein, Huck Seed, Tom Dwan, Patrick Antonius.
You can go on forever. I don't think there's a pro out there that won't sign this letter. This is just ludicrous, the statements and the stance that the Commerce is taking.
Now, when Tom Malkasian testified before the Barney Frank Committee in opposition to H.R. 2267, he brought up some things that the Commerce wanted, which have actually been included in the bill thanks to amendments. For instance, they wanted only licensed sites to be able to do online poker if they had facilities here in the United States. That was in the markup of the bill. He complained that 90 days wasn't enough time for a state or a tribe to opt out of the legislation. The bill was amended to say instead of 90 days, one full legislative session. So California or Missouri or Pennsylvania or Florida,
whatever, yeah,
can decide whether they want to be part of national online poker or make it on their own. Malkasian said that the bill allowed illegal foreign sites to be licensed despite their past actions, but there were a couple amendments put in there saying if you've been committing an intentional felony violation of federal or state gambling laws, you can't even apply for a license. Well, sites like PokerStars and Full Tilt Poker and others have never been charged with a crime and certainly have not intentionally committed felonious acts here and have never been convicted of one, so they wouldn't be there. So the PPA, through their spokesperson, their executive director, John Pappas, said, Commerce's concerns have been addressed. Quote, I assume they should now support the bill. I think the only logical conclusion as to why they're opposing the bill is that they are scared to compete, not only with offshore sites like Stars and Full Tilt and others, but with Harrah's and maybe Google and anybody else who would want to get involved. They would prefer at Commerce Casino to set up an intrastate monopoly in California. In other words, Commerce wants to get into the online business and they don't want to have competition with the existing poker sites. Now, you've been very involved in this. Tell me your take on all this, Dennis.
Well, it's a logical conclusion. And if it's wrong, we need the Commerce to come out and tell us some other reason why they would be in such opposition to this. PokerStars and Full Tilt and the other companies that are offshores that have been supporting the PPA adamantly have no problem with the competition. They are welcoming it. They are actually throwing money in there and asking their players to support this, asking for free competition.
Yep.
Asking to just be a part of a level playing field. That's all the heck they want.
Yep.
And why would not the Commerce support that? So instead, they want to throw a barrier, in effect, around the state of California so that only people in California can play against other players in California.
Only on sites run by, perhaps, the Commerce Casino.
There you go. So one site. That's it. They want one site.
And they want to be
monopoly.
The ones who run it.
And by the way, if you're only going to have one site, we'd be the ones who'd be happy to do it.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Now, Commerce says they support online poker.
How?
Well, only if it's through them, I think, is really it. I mean, first of all, there is no internet or Masters intrastate online poker bill that has a chance of survival in California right now. And Commerce says that they've pushed for poker in California, but when Rod Wright, a representative in California, brought one up in the California State Senate, Commerce said they don't like that legislation because there was too much competition allowed. In other words, other sites not called the Commerce Casino online would have been allowed to do this.
So in other words, they were going to make it available to, you know, the best site maybe. Wow.
Yeah. So here's my question to you. A lot of these pros who live in the Los Angeles area, or even those from Vegas who go out to Commerce to play when they have their WPT event,
correct,
or other things, sometimes just to go to play in the big cash games, or in any of the other events that happen at the Commerce on a regular basis, do you think that there's going to be backlash against them and some of these pros will refuse to play there?
There already has been some backlash. I don't know how big backlash will it end up being. There are individuals that have said they will not play at the Commerce anymore. I'm not for sure that I'm not for sure where this is going to go. You have two different issues here, I have to admit. This is a mecca for poker players. This is where you can go to get some great action, some great games. They've thrown some huge tournaments out there and been very successful, some televised tournaments. All of that is positive. They know how to take care of people when they're physically there. But if they're going to, in effect, oppose the average player, the guy that's in Montana, Missouri, New Jersey, whatever, and restrict their play and cause problems for them to play and for that freedom, I have a problem going out there and play, and I'm sure a lot of other people are going to have that too.
Now, what about the idea of a California-only online site? Because California is a huge economy unto itself. It's the most populous state in the country. It is the sixth largest economy in the world without the other 49 states.
Correct.
There are certainly enough people in California to support online poker within that state. But would the players in Los Angeles and San Bernardino and San Francisco and San Diego and all the places that don't have San in their name, would they want to only play against other Californians, or would they want to play against us here in the Midwest and people on the East Coast and, frankly, people who are in Europe and Africa and Asia and everywhere else on the globe?
Well, just look at it this way. How much of a problem and how much stricter is that going to be? You have Sunday right now, which there are monster tournaments on every online site.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest in the world are happening there. If this legislation would pass and the Commerce would become the monopoly in California, you could not play on that. You would not play on the Sunday Million. You would not play on the Full Tilt's monster mega Sunday deal that they have.
Yep.
You couldn't play on any of those.
Yep.
And even if They allowed some way or other some other competition in there and for these online companies to do it. With that wall up there, the only PokerStars players you could play against would be the ones that live in California.
Mm-hmm.
You could not play against a PokerStars player that's sitting in Nevada or anywhere else. It's going to massively reduce the field that's playing. It's going to massively reduce the type of games you can have because you won't have near as many players. It's a huge, huge difference.
Now, we have seen something like this go on in Europe, both France and Italy,
correct,
have said, we're going to have online poker, but only within our own borders. So French players can only play against French players on PokerStars. Italian players can only play against,
correct,
Italian players on PokerStars. But that's a whole country, not a part of that country.
Mm-hmm.
California certainly is up there in terms of size and population, but do Italy and France restrict it to only one poker site?
They do not. They allow free competition within it. To my knowledge, there's somewhere around at least a dozen of them in Italy, and I'm not sure how many in France now. And because of those restrictions and because that country wanted to do that, PokerStars abided by it, did the laws, went in there, applied for and paid for license, became just a regular company in there on the online, and did the free competition and are competing that way.
Mm-hmm.
And if California wanted to restrict it to California, which I think is very poor for poker players,
yes,
but wanted to set it up as free competition and free enterprise, I'm quite sure PokerStars and Full Tilt would open their sites there and would abide by the law and would do everything required
move
of it.
Move their personnel, move
if
their
that's
servers
what it takes,
there.
Whatever it takes, they will abide by it and do it, and they will follow the law to the letter.
Yep.
And will be compliant with everything that the legislature would pass. But how could you have it with only one company and set up a quote monopoly,
yes,
in there? And why would anybody except the people that have that monopoly want it?
And by the way, when have monopolies been good for consumers in any business.
Oh, yeah. Let's go back to a monopoly in the railroad or a monopoly in oil or a monopoly in
phone
whatever.
Company.
The, phone company.
Yeah. When
wow,
Bob
I wonder
Bell
what happened
the
there. Yeah. We don't have any history of that at all, do we?
Now, one last thing about this. Commerce says that they're not the only California casino opposed to the Barney Frank bill. They say that the Bike and Hollywood Park and Hawaiian Gardens, just in the Los Angeles area, are also opposed to Barney Frank's bill. But I think there's a difference between because Commerce stepped up. They sent Tom Malkasian to Washington to testify against this and to be the leader of the We Want a Monopoly movement in there. And if there's going to be backlash against Commerce, I think it's going to be for that reason. I don't think you're going to see people boycotting the Bike or Hollywood Park or Hawaiian Gardens. I think there might be some poker player backlash against the Commerce. I don't know.
I don't either. I want to see where this goes, and I want to see where the response are, because right now their arguments don't hold water. They absolutely do not. And if they can't come up with a better explanation as to why they're opposing this, because as you so vividly pointed out, they opposed it for A, B, C, and D. And guess what? We put amendments in there for A, B, C, and D.
That's exactly right. Okay.
Wow.
If you are not a member of the Poker Players Alliance, this is yet another reason why you need to join. And if that's not enough, I'm going to get a little plug in here for yet another one of our causes, which is states cracking down on home games.
Oh.
Last Thursday, a high-stakes home game in North Carolina was raided, $23,700 confiscated, 8 people arrested. That's an average of about $3,000 per person. That's
right.
That's a pretty deep, pretty good home
that
game.
Is.
Why is the state busting poker players in their own home? On Sunday, in Columbus, Georgia, 15 people were busted for playing poker in the back of a beauty salon. Why,
sorry.
Guys, there? Fine. Bust them for the cocaine. Don't bust them for playing poker. But North Carolina and Georgia are both states where it's illegal to have a home game. This is the sort of nonsense that also needs to be changed. This is not, when you join the PPA, it's not just about online poker. It's against all regulations about our game that make it impossible to play our game wherever and whenever you want as a free American citizen. You need to join thePPA.org. That's the website for the Poker Players Alliance. We're proud to be sponsored by them and to be members of the PPA as well. We'll take a break, and then when we come back, we'll meet another member of the November 9. We've already introduced you to John Reisner and Jason Senti and Michael Mizrachi. Now here's a guy who's in the middle of the pack, literally 5th out of 9 in chip stack when they go to play the main event of the World Series of Poker in November. Matt Jarvis joins us when we come back with more of the Final Table. He's Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. This is Five Night of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, with our podcasts available via iTunes and through the chipleader.com. Welcome back to the Final Table, the weekly poker show originating from Harrah's St. Louis and brought to you by PokerStars.net. That's the website where you can play against the big name pros like my partner Dennis Phillips.
And a lot of the others that you named in there in that PPA listing, Greg Gramer, Chris Moneymaker, all the rest of them. What's coming up starting September 5th is what they call the WCOOP, the World Championship of Online Poker. If you go to PokerStars.net, download and start playing, you can qualify for free for some of the largest and most lucrative tournaments ever to be put out. They are guaranteeing in prizes, guaranteeing over $50 million over the next 3 weeks.
Sweet.
Sweet is right. Go to PokerStars.net. You can qualify for free. And
by qualify, you mean free roll into these
free
events.
Free roll. Absolutely. Not costing you a dime just to get in there to this. It's unbelievable. The rewards are possible. And don't forget, they also have trips all around the world. We're talking about to Australia, to Latin America, to wherever. I'm going to Argentina. Maybe I'll see somebody down there.
Maybe you will.
All right. PokerStars.net, the place to play, my friends.
All right. Joining us on our guest segment today is another member of this year's November 9, Matt Jarvis, who, if he wins it, I believe, Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, if you win the main event this year, you'll be the first Canadian to do that. Is that true?
I think that is very true.
Well, so, welcome to our Final Table. We're happy to have you here.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
And congratulations on your victory last week up in Calgary.
Yeah, thank you. It was my first heads-up tournament live to play, and yeah, it was actually a lot of fun. I love the best of three formats, and got a lot of great experience, so it was good.
I love the heads-up format, too, and that is a very, very good structure there. Being able to start out with the 10,000 and, what was it, 25-50 beginning and 20-minute levels instead of 15 or 10-minute level like some of them do.
Exactly.
You said you hadn't played that before. What did you take out of that? Did that in any way maybe help you for your preparation for the November 9?
I think it definitely did. Like, you know, you can go through a whole field and you know, you can only really win the tournament if you can play solidly heads-up and... yeah, I had some really tough opponents. I played Brad Booth, Bushman Online, Compton Masta, a few really, really solid players. And, yeah, I had to adjust to a few live guy styles and a few online player styles. And, yeah, it just really helped me to kind of get focused and adjusted, I think, for what I'm going to have to do in November.
Sweet. Were there any memorable hands there? Where maybe the river card was really interesting, shall we say?
Well, there was. I played one hand. The final match, I played one hand a little bit interesting. I just flatted with nines heads up. I think at the 25-50 level, and just against a single raise out of position, and flop 9-6-2, and I check raised, and he ended up having queens, and I ended up getting. Three streets of value, and who knows, if I 3-bet and he 4-bet, I might have even had to dump the hand at that point. So that really kind of set the starting of the final match, and I think at that point I maybe had like a 16,000 to 4,000 chip lead after that hand. So
then you can be bully.
Yeah, and then it was just kind of a little bit bullying, but I'm sure there were others. Played a really bunch of interesting hands with Brad Booth and. Some really tough matches for sure.
One of the hard things on heads up is to not be predictable, because you can get into betting patterns very easily. You can get into, especially with this kind of a structure where you are playing for several. I mean, I played for a little over 5 hours, almost 5.5 hours on my the match that I had up there, the one that I ended up losing. Did you have any real marathon sessions?
Actually, every single one was a marathon.
Went.
I had my first five matches all went three games. And I was down one in three of those. I was down the first match in three of those. So all of those were basically marathons, like 5 hours. And it wasn't until the final match that I won two straight. But wow, are they ever grueling and tiring? It's like you just get so many more hands than you would full ring. And at the end of it, you're like, you know, it's taking me right even till now to kind of. Just actually breathe and relax after that.
Because when you're playing a full ring, either tournament or cash game, you know, you're playing maybe 30% of the hands, 20%, maybe 40% of the. I mean, if you're playing a lot of hands, you're playing 40% of the hands. So 60% of the time, you get to sit back, and while you're still paying attention, you're not in full concentration mode the way you are in a heads-up match where you have to be paying attention because you're involved in every single hand.
Every single hand. Like, you get just... almost no time off, really. It's just like bang, 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 hand after hand.
The two things I like about it in your preparation, I think, it's very difficult to get quality play shorthanded, and you need to be able to practice that heads up or against two people or three people or something like that. And this gave you hours and hours of heads up.
Totally.
Plus, if you're actually trying to perfect your reads and your tells and your instincts against the person, when you can concentrate on one person for 2 or 3 hours, if you don't have a good read by the end of then, you're not going to get one.
This is true. So. Yeah, you have to try and find it as much as you can early. And excuse me. I think that's one thing that I really benefited of the best of three was that, you know, sometimes it took a match or a little bit to kind of really get down the reads and things like this and playing patterns. But you know, I think by the third match came along and I had to win five matches in the third game. I really felt like I knew the player, and I just felt like that third match became much more of, you know, much more calculated spots because of the information I already had.
Of course, the converse is also true. The other guy or woman is getting the chance to study you for that amount of time. And this is probably something you need to apply when you get to the November 9, particularly under the bright lights and the pressure of the TV cameras and the huge amounts of money that you're going to be playing for come November. Do you have to be extra conscious of what you're doing, and did this help you in that way?
Yes, I think over the last year, one of the things I've tried to perfect as much as I can is to try and be in a very still, kind of robotic, like still robotic movements, doing as little actual movement and gestures as I can. Everything is very kind of slow and methodical, and you know, I've seen videotape of myself, and I'm trying to get it to the point where I am giving off as little as I can, just by doing it, like whether checking, betting, any of that stuff, just try and do it the same every single time, much like Chris Ferguson.
Yeah, Chris is the one to model after. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to snap your fingers to see if he's still alive.
This is true.
But there's nothing wrong with that. No. Another thing that kind of brings up, everybody's going to be analyzing you for the next several months, especially eight people that I can name right now. And they're going to watch everything that you've done on ESPN. They're going to watch everything that's going to be on you from what you played up there in Canada. I think you're going to London and wherever else you happen to be.
Yes.
Can you, dare you, shall I say, try to change your schedule or try to mix it up a little different when you hit that November 9 table?
I think there's always going to be adjustments and trying to find ways to counter opponents and things like this. I'm going to use the information that they're going to use against me to try and make my adjustments and make my decisions as best I can. You know, you want to know the information they have about you and just find ways of doing whatever you can to not duplicate or replicate things that they would expect you to do, I guess.
See, this is what I love about poker. Because now you're analyzing them and what they're probably going to do, and you're turning around and you assume they're analyzing you and what you're expected to do, and once you figure out what you're supposed to do, then you can change around and not do what they expect you to do so they won't do what you expect them to do.
And for anybody who thinks poker is only about what cards come up, this is the psychology of poker. This is that level 4 thinking. What does he think? I think he thinks I'm thinking about while he's thinking about what I'm thinking about what he's saying.
For sure. It's unbelievable.
God, I love it. It is.
I do too. It's just so great to try and get inside the head of your opponents and really try and and just get a step ahead of them and realize that get into that metagame and realize that that, you know, they're thinking this and you got to do whatever you can to counter that, and it's just this back and forth mind war, and it's so much fun.
Matt, oh, it is.
Matt, we've talked to three of the other guys in the November 9, Michael Mizrachi and John Reisner and Jason Senti, and we've asked all of them this question, and I want to ask you as well. Talk about marathon sessions. When you guys got down to 10 players, it took almost 5 hours, maybe a little bit more, to get that bubble broken and get down to the November 9. You're now a member of the November 9, right in the middle of the pack with 16.7 million in chips. Tell us about the November 9 bubble. When you were playing down from 10 to 9 for all of those hours, did you have a strategy in mind, and were you only focused on making the November 9? Was that the most important thing, and did it affect your play?
It definitely did. It's almost like hanging on to a tree branch that's hanging over a canyon and just, like, you know, hanging on for dear life. It's just, you can't really stress how big that bubble was. And, you know, everyone wants to try and get to the November 9. And that's the thing, you couldn't win the tournament on day 8. You can only get into the November 9. And, you know, so it essentially becomes a super satellite. And, everyone's just kind of hanging on. I think if I had to say, I would say John Dolan played that bubble about as good as possible. He really put the pressure on Joseph, and it was kind of a bit of a frustrating time for me. I had fallen from, you know, close to chip lead of about 33 million, slowly down. Reisner was playing really good against me, and so was Mizrachi, and I fell from 33 to almost a quarter of that, around 8, and now I realize that I'm in this position that I could go out in 10th spot, and it was a scary, scary feeling.
Did you make any big laydowns? Jason Senti told us that everybody's going to laugh at him on ESPN when they show that he folded queens in a tough situation because he was thinking about, well, you know what? I'd rather lay these down and make the November 9 than go out in 10th place with these queens and find out that I'm up against somebody else's 3 or 4 bet. I can't remember the exact situation. He says, you know what? No matter what anybody thinks, I'm in the November 9. Yes, this I had to true. Lay down queens to get here, but I did. Did you have a situation like that?
I didn't really have much of a situation like that. I had I was actually kind of card dead through that time, but at the same time, I had to make I had to really kind of strategize because, like, you can just only raise fold so much in that spot, and so normally when you might be, you know, stealing or attacking the blinds, it is a spot. Well, you know, if one of these guys are going to put the pressure back on me, I can't really do much. So I really, you know, you really had to kind of slow yourself down and realize that this is no longer like a regular tournament. This is, you know, get that one guy knocked out and let's get into the final nine.
All right, Matt, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we want to talk a little bit about what was so inspirational about your story, and that, of course, is the story of your dad who got sick and still said you should go on to play in the World Series of Poker. We'll tell that story when we come back with more of the Final Table. He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris talking with Matt Jarvis, one of this year's November 9 of the World Series of Poker main event. On 5-9 of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and you can download podcasts of the Final Table from Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. Welcome back to the Final Table, the weekly poker radio show with Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. We are at Table 2 at Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, where if you're a tournament player, you get lots of opportunities to play 2 tournaments a day every single week. And if you've never played in a tournament and you're thinking, well, you know what, I really don't want to get into a big buy-in event, well, they've got 8 opportunities during the week where you can get in for $60 and 4 opportunities during the week where you can get into the tournaments for $40. And they get lots of people in here for these tournaments. I think they had 9 tables for the 1 o'clock event today. So they range from $40 to $60 to $125 and $160 tournaments, and once a month, a $310 buy-in event. For the full schedule, you can go to harrahs.com/STLpoker. And if you're looking for food, Sammy's, the restaurant owned by Sammy Hagar here at Harrah's St. Louis, has a whole new menu. And they've got a happy hour that goes on Wednesday through Sunday from 3 to 6 with half-price appetizers and drink specials. And Sammy's Beach Bar and Grill has an all-new menu with all sorts of recipes that Sammy has picked up from some of his favorite friends as he's traveled across America. He's met all sorts of chefs, and they've suggested things. It's American fare with an island twist, and 100% of the food from Sammy's Beach Bar and Grill goes to the Hagar Family Foundation, which helps out groups here in St. Louis, a private nonprofit that Sammy established in 2008. So every time you eat there, you're helping out some nonprofits here in St. Louis, just one of the many fine restaurants here at Harrah's St. Louis.
And we've been talking to Matt Jarvis, the 25-year-old Canadian who went against 7,319 people in the main event, and he's one of the final 9, sitting currently 5th in chips. And a lot of things going on out there, a huge amount of pressures, over 7,000 people in it, and you had a few other things going on in your mind at that time. Your dad, if I remember right, was just recently diagnosed with cancer right before you went down there?
Yes, he was. About a month before the World Series started, my dad, you know, I'd just been out golfing them lots, and he had been doing great. Anyway, was diagnosed with cancer of the tonsils and the lymph nodes. Mm. And by the time we kind of, you know, got the testing and everything like that done, found out that it was stage 4, which is basically the final stage or the last stage of cancer. And anyway, I really wanted to stay home and be with my family and you know, help any way I could. And my dad just kind of said, "No, son, you know, go down and you know, this is what you do. This is what you've been looking forward to." And he just kind of pushed me into going. And I think, you know, now that he's on the recovery and everything's going great, it's very happy that he pushed me that way.
That's phenomenal. Did you only play the main event, or were you there for other events?
I was there right from the start. I got there late May, and I realized that, you know, the first two or three weeks that this was really still on my mind, and I actually really kind of struggled getting my mind and head around it and really kind of focusing in. It took me up until kind of late June that I really kind of started getting things going in some of the Venetian tournaments. And, anyway, I came back home, spent some time with my family, came back for, you know, time with them and also a bachelor party. And then and talked to my dad, and he sent me away with my mom, and came back down with my girlfriend and played the main event. Now November 9th. So.
and played.
Yeah. Wow. What a marathon.
Were you calling home with updates to dad every break?
All the time.
That's good.
I spent a lot of focus this year not trying to do updates on things like Facebook, and I felt like it just kind of was adding pressure to myself. So, but one thing I did do was always update them. I would talk to them probably 6 or 7 times daily, and both of them just were really excited for me, but tried to keep me as grounded as they could. So, it was. I have a really great family, and they really were very, very supportive.
Well, our best thoughts to your dad.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
So, tell him hi from me, and maybe we'll see him out there in November.
Definitely.
So that would be good. I would love if you could introduce me to him. I'd like to shake his hand. He's got a pretty good son.
So, thank you. All right. We'll do.
Another question we usually ask everybody. Are you considering anything in getting a poker coach or getting some tutelage or anything special you're doing to prepare for this November 9?
I am. I was considering it before. I think this heads up win has really kind of given me a lot of confidence. And I have a very good core of poker friends that are really kind of good to bounce things off and things like that. And I was thinking about getting a coach, but at the same time, I feel that it's just better if I just stick with the crew that I already have. We're going to work a lot of things out. We're going to study tape and you know, try and set up a replica situation and of the actual November 9 and really trying to do whatever we can to think of how we're going to strategize against each and every player. But as for coaching, I think I'm probably just going to leave it with the group that I have.
ESPN has been getting pretty good ratings this year.
Oh, yeah.
They're up 15% from last year for their coverage.
Beautiful.
And tonight will be day 2B. Phil Ivey and Dan Harrington and Jeff Shulman and Josh Arie will be in there. For the November 9, you know, the Grinder is a name. And so...
Yeah.
Attention of the cameras in the first. When do we start seeing you and Soy and Jonathan and John and Jason and Filippo? Any idea when the cameras started catching up with you and your action?
I think it was mostly on day 3 or day 4 was when they kind of started to follow me. I think what day was it again with the bubble? I think it was day 4. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it's mostly that day then, day 4. I played with Humberto Brenes on day 3, and I was actually at Joseph's table late in day 3 as well. But, you know, we didn't get a ton of coverage. Day 4, Barry Shulman was at my table, and I went from just being like an average stack to really pounding the bubble. And I went from being an average to one of the top 5 chip leaders, so... The camera started kind of coming around, and I think on right around bubble time, I think I won a stretch of like 9 of 10 hands or something like this. So, it was a very good bubble for me, and it definitely kind of put me in the spot that I am in now, and hopefully that's when the TV coverage will start for me.
Yeah, Dennis will attest to this. Once you get chips, you go from being, who is this guy, to who is this guy?
It's true.
It does make a difference. Well, last year we had a wide variety. I think Joe Cotto was the leader of day 1C or whatever
right.
day he played, and some of the other people were short stacked by day 3, so it's always a variety of it. It's interesting how to play. When you're playing, preparing for that, one thing I found that was helpful, I got some friends of mine, we played some sit-and-goes. So you practice playing three-handed and four-handed in that, and did it a couple of times being short-stacked or with a deep stack and, you know, varying it that way.
You know, I can't quite remember, Dennis, how many of those sit-and-goes did you win?
Well, there it was a little bit of a mini handicap. One of my coaches one time says, you have to fold the first 20 hands and then play. So, you know, it was a little bit of a handicap every now and then.
Whoa.
You know, another time he wouldn't let me look at cards. So I'm playing against half a dozen sharks, and I can't even look at my cards.
Wow, unbelievable.
So,
yeah, we did line up some of the best players in St. Louis to play against them, which I think was good training.
Oh, it
for
was.
You.
It was absolutely great. No, and I thank those guys, and you know, I bought them a couple of suppers or something, which was well worth it.
Yeah, you absolutely did. Well, Matt, we appreciate you coming on the show today. We'll keep an eye on you as the ESPN coverage gets a little bit closer to the bubble and see how you do going forward. We, of course, know you're going to make it to the November 9. We look forward to seeing you out there, and we really appreciate you coming to the final table today.
Hey, no problem, guys. Really enjoyed it. And for everyone else out there, if they want to follow me on Facebook and Twitter and everything else, I'm really trying to get that stuff going as well. So thank you very much.
What's your screen name on Twitter?
On Twitter, it's Matt Jarvis Poker. I just actually started my account today.
All right. We will put a link to it on thechipleader.com when we post the podcast of this show, and people can follow you there. Thanks again,
Perfect.
Matt.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Take care, Matt.
Matt Jarvis, who is right in the middle of the pack, fifth in chips out of the November 9 when they get to the final table of the main event of the World Series of Poker come this fall. Now, while we're talking about ESPN's coverage of the main event, getting ratings up 15%, a couple of other things about TV poker I want to mention. The World Poker Tour has signed a new deal with FSN. After all those years on the Travel Channel, they made their move to Fox Sports Net a couple of years ago. They've signed a new three-year deal. Matt Savage, who is their new tournament director, has made some changes to it. They've signed a deal with one of the Seminole Hard Rock casinos in Florida. Florida, a market that, as we've talked about, is exploding because they finally took the limits off in July.
Correct.
And I talked to a friend of ours from here in St. Louis. I'm not going to say his name, but he went down there for a two-week trip, and he hit six different Florida casinos and said he understands why a lot of poker pros are moving down there. He said it is one of the softest poker markets, just as everybody predicted it would be.
Yep.
Remember we talked to Michael Mizraki,
oh, yes, absolutely,
who is from Florida, and his whole family's down there, and they're probably eating large down there with a lot of the fish there. He said it is, how did he put it? Our friend called it the poker seafood capital of America,
yeah.
Because it's a state full of poker fish right now. So the WPT will have an event down there. And Mike Matusow won the Florida State Poker Championship for $100,000 a couple of weeks ago.
Correct.
Which by my math means he only owes Ted Forrest $1.9 million.
Yeah, Ted might have been waiting in line with him.
And also on the subject of televised poker, some of the people on 2+2, the poker forum,
mm-hmm.
Somebody put together a list of everybody who's played on high-stakes poker over the past six seasons.
Okay.
They went to check the win-loss record for every player over these 6 years of high-stakes poker. Now, they put together the top 10 winners and the top 10 losers. You are on neither list.
Thank you.
After your one experience there.
I mean, the one list would be awesome, but the other one I don't want to be on.
See if you can guess who the number one winner on high-stakes poker over these last six seasons might be. I'll give you multiple choice here. Is it Phil Ivey, Barry Greenstein, Tom Dwan, or David Benjamin?
If I had to guess one of those, I'd guess David.
David is second, winning $904,150.
Okay.
Number one, Tom Dwan.
He hasn't had a losing one yet.
$1,756,500 over six seasons. He has been the star player on there.
Okay.
Doyle is third, with just over $750,000, then Matusow, Patrick Antonius, Phil Ivey, Eli Elezra, Barry Greenstein, Eric Lindgren, and Mimi Tran, who I think may have done only one or two sessions on high-stakes poker very early on.
Right. That one shocks me.
We have not seen her in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who do you think is the number one loser? This one should be easy to figure out because he's lost in every season and sometimes in brutal fashion.
Well, Daniel's been hurt just a little bit.
$2.18 million in losses for Daniel Negreanu.
Wow.
Phil Galfond lost $400,000. Zygmunt lost $360,000. Dario Minieri, $328,000. Antonio Esfandiari, all just over $250,000. Sean Chican, almost $250,000. Daniel Alai, $222,000. Jamie Gold, famous for that one hand where he lost like $180,000 against Sammy Farha.
Right.
When he confused Sammy with his kings against Sammy's aces and should have lost a lot more. Jamie's record is minus $217,000. Todd Brunson, who plays like a nit every time he's on TV. I don't know if he plays like that at the at Bobby's room, but when he was on the big game a couple weeks ago, there hasn't been a bigger nit on TV than Todd Brunson. He's down $202,000. And Silent Mike Baxter, as Gabe Kaplan always calls him, down $200,000 for his six seasons on high-stakes poker.
I'm actually surprised that some of the losses weren't bigger than that. I mean, $200,000 is huge. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But when you start out with a stake of a minimum of $200,000.
Right.
You know, just getting felted on an aces versus kings, and boom, you're there.
Absolutely.
So.
What else do I have to mention here? We talked about the WPT. Kathy Liebert has now become the second player to have played in 100 WPT events. Eric Seidel, the only other player to play 100 times. Kathy did that at the Legends of Poker event at the Bike in California a few weeks ago. That's where she played her first ever WPT event and now has played her 100th event. She is the winningest female in WPT history with $1.7 million in winnings. But if you think about it, events and a $10,000 buy-in, that means she's bought in for $1 million and has returned $1.75 million.
It's still a nice return.
$750,000, but over the course of, what is it, eight seasons
now. It's season eight, I believe, yes.
So she's averaged under $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And if you, after taxes and all the rest, there's a lot of money. And the final thing I want to mention here is a report out on Alzheimer's. Why would Alzheimer's be mentioned on a poker show? Because it talks about, once you get to age 65, how important it is to remain active and do things that keep your mind active. And what's one of the things they say you should do? Play cards.
There you go.
Playing cards helps fight off dementia in old age. And poker, of course, is the best way to play cards.
What were we talking about?
That's why the story we had a few months ago of the old folks' home that had a poker game going on that got raided by
that.
The local cops was even more of a travesty. These people were keeping themselves healthy.
All right, I want a doctor's order. You have to play poker after age 55. How's that?
Well, the story was about 65, but you're talking about yourself there at 55.
You got it.
All right, that's all for the final table this week. Next week, we will talk with Joey Stapleton, who is doing a great job as the analyst on The Big Game, the Poker Stars show, which is not on the air in St. Louis, but is on some Fox stations across the country. If you haven't seen it yet, go to PokerStars.tv and pick it up there. In the meantime, check out all of our podcasts on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, where you can also buy our Final Table merchandise. And where are you off to, Dennis?
Well, I got several things going on, but I'm going to be in Foxwoods to be playing some tournaments there. I'll be going to Argentina. I'll be going to London, traveling the world like usual.
All right. Next week, we'll have a report from wherever Dennis is. I will be right back here at Table 2 at Harrah's St. Louis. That's the home of The Final Table. Heard live every week on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And those podcasts available on thechipleader.com. Thanks for listening.